We are flirting with climate disaster.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour. We'd like to acknowledge that we're on the land of the Wadawurrung people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're on stolen land, land that was never ceded, always was, and always will be First Nations land. Reconciliation Week was held last week. In a couple of weeks' time, we'll be having NAIDOC Week. Two very special weeks in the calendar for our First Nations people. We are so proud to promote their ancient wisdom that they've honed from learning, from nurturing both their land and their communities for millennia before their land was stolen. And there are so many answers for us in that ancient wisdom as we navigate the climate crisis.
That's a young climate activist from Rising Tide, Alexa Stewart, interrupting Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's press conference where he was about to announce Labour's commitment for mental health funding.
What I wanted to do today was to draw attention to the hypocrisy of our government, who on one hand says that they care about young people, and yet on the other are continuing to fuel the climate crisis by approving new coal and gas projects. You know, as a young person, I feel so angry and upset. I have experienced eco-anxiety since I have been 15. I am worried that my future will be full of increased floods, fires, famine, and drought. And I know that the number one driver of that is the continued approval of new coal and gas projects.
A clip which SBS put out on their Instagram page. And while Alexa was screaming to Albo that his Labour government is condemning young people to a lifetime of climate disasters with all these new coal and gas projects that they keep opening and approving, you see Albanese standing there on the stage, calmly smiling to the audience, signaling, don't worry about her. And in the meanwhile, the security personnel is busy carrying Alexa out of the room. Well, I think maybe instead of shouting and protesting and trying to reach the attention of our politicians, who so very obviously will not listen. Last weekend, I was thinking maybe we need to engage more openly and more positively with the fossil fuel people themselves. So last weekend, I wrote a letter to that spokesperson from Viva Energy here in Geelong, who was quoted in the newspaper on Friday in the Geelong Independent as saying, "A gas terminal would be good news for Geelong. A reliable and affordable supply of gas is critical for industry and manufacturing, supporting employment and economic growth." I would like to welcome this spokesperson who didn't want his or her name out. Maybe to have a cup of coffee, meet at a local cafe and talk this through. You know, there's some perspectives on this that I would be very interested in hearing Viva Energy's response to. First of all, this thing about reliable. You know, describing gas as being reliable, is it? Gas supply, first of all, we know it's a finite resource. The wells are going to run dry eventually. That's, on the long term, not very reliable. But further than that, it's a fuel that leaks. It's really toxic. People die from inhaling it. And there's the risk of explosion. To me, none of that says reliability, honestly. And then this thing about affordable. Gas is known today to be the most expensive form of energy in our energy mix. It's the reason why we have high electricity prices. As we heard last week, where we had Colin Long explain to us, and he knows about this because he is a part of a team that runs an energy retailer, and explaining why gas is the reason that our electricity prices are so high. That's a well-established fact. So households and businesses would all be financially better off by switching from gas to electric. Who exactly is gas affordable for, I would ask? I could go on, and I'll put a link to this letter I wrote, which is maybe, you know, twice as long as what I'm saying here, in the show notes. But the last thing is about employment, claiming that this is about creating jobs and so on. As we get more and more renewables in the system, fossil fuel jobs are on their way out. And where is that transition plan, Viva Energy, for your workers, your gas workers, when eventually this terminal will become a stranded asset? It's clearly time not to invest anymore in fossil fuels. You know, if we want long-term secure jobs in Geelong, we need to put our jobs where the future is, which is in energy efficiency, in battery storage, and in anything electric, basically. My point here is that I think it would be good if climate activists and the fossil fuel industry was able maybe to speak more respectfully to one another or openly and try to understand where we're coming from, each of us. On the page where I put out my letter, I also put quite a bit of information about what's happening to our climate. Because to me, that is the reason why I'm talking about this issue. You know, I wouldn't be worried about that other people want to use gas. I don't want personally, but other people, sure, if you want to use gas. But the problem is, when you use gas, you are also ruining my children's future in the way that you are putting that pollution up in the atmosphere. And if we get more and more problems with the climate, as we know by now. So anyway, speaking of problems with the climate, every week we hear what's happening around the world from Colin Mockett, OAM, our reporter who's got an eye on what's going on. And what do you have for us today, Colin? Good news or bad news?
Bad news, Mick, and it's pretty much related to what you've been speaking about. Our roundup today begins in Paris, where to surprise of nobody, a new report found from the World Meteorological Organization detailed how climate change reached new heights last year. State of the Global Climate 2024 document was released, and it recorded high global sea surface temperatures and greenhouse gas concentrations. The report detailed that the atmosphere concentrate of carbon dioxide recorded last year was the highest level in the last 800,000 years. That's last year was the highest in that length of time. And they record it by looking at the carbon in fossils. And they can go back that far. So it really refutes the argument that people use to say that the climate has always been changing. Even in the time of fires which ravaged in our prehistoric times, there was nothing like what we're putting into the atmosphere now. And meanwhile, back home here in Australia, our top oil and gas executives met last week in Brisbane at the Australian Energy Producers Conference. Although held behind closed doors, it became apparent that the fossil fuel industry does not see government opposition nor protest movements as its biggest future threats. Both have been seen off by recent political moves. What the industry now fears most is what it calls activist lawfare, meaning fossil fuel and mining companies being taken to court because of the harm that they cause. At a session titled From Placards to Plaintiffs, panelists from Santos and Woodside heard a list of reasons why public interest climate litigation is now the most dangerous threat to their continuing business. They listed a number of strategies to combat these, including delegitimizing those plaintiffs or painting them as either sophisticated operatives with huge budgets or unserious infantile activists with ideological legal strategies. Either way, it looks like the next phase of climate activism is set to be in the courts. And elsewhere in Australia, another new report shows that last week's decision by the Environment Minister, Murray Watt, to sign off on Western Australia's huge Northwest gas project is not the end of the gas industry's planned expansions. There are six more really big projects already in the pipeline, and I'll list them for you. They start with number one, the Barossa gas project. That's located about 300 kilometres north of Darwin in the Timor Sea. It's run by Santos and priced at $5.6 billion. The federal government approved this back in April. It will extract gas from the Barossa field and transport it to a liquefied natural gas facility in Darwin for processing and export. Virtually all of the gas that we're finding around Australia is exported, we should point out here. Now, this venture would reportedly be among the worst polluting oil and gas projects in the world, expected to release about 380 million tonnes of climate pollution over its 25-year life. Number two is the Scarborough-Pluto Train 2 project. This is an extension of Woodside's existing Scarborough project, centred around a gas field about 375 kilometres off WA's Pilbara coast. This project is about 80% complete, has federal and state approval, and is scheduled to begin operating by next year. According to Climate Analytics, it would create about 9.2 million tonnes of carbon dioxide equivalent each year. Number three is Surat Phase 2 in Gladstone, Queensland. That'll be operated by Arrow Energy. That's a joint venture between Shell and PetroChina. It involves substantially expanding existing gas fields by building up to 450 new production wells. At its peak, the project is expected to supply 130 million cubic feet of gas daily. Number four is the Narrabri gas project in northwest New South Wales. It involves drilling up to 850 coal seam gas wells over 95,000 hectares. The National Native Title Tribunal last month ruled leases for the project could be granted, leaving Santos only a few regulatory barriers to clear. Environmental groups and traditional owners argue that the project threatens water resources, biodiversity, and indigenous sites. However, the tribunal found the project's benefits to energy reliability outweighed those concerns. Number five is the Beetaloo Basin, located 500 kilometres southeast of Darwin. It covers 28,000 kilometres. It's estimated to contain up to 500 trillion cubic feet of gas, and a number of countries are vying for the right to develop this resource, which is predicted to emit up to 1.2 billion tonnes over 25 years. And finally, number six, Browse Basin, which is 425 kilometres north of Broome, off WA. It's considered Australia's biggest reserve of untapped conventional gas. Woodside plans to develop the Browse gas fields, but the area is remote and difficult to access. Environmental groups say the project, if approved, would emit 1.6 billion tonnes of climate pollution, and that's three times Australia's current annual emissions. They're all either approved or about to be approved, showing that basically our government and the companies are ignoring the call from everybody in the world to cut back on gas. And just to put all of this into perspective, the Federal Treasury figures last week showed that climate-related weather disasters hit the Australian economy for more than $2 billion in the first half of this year. Events including Cyclone Alfred and floods in New South Wales and Queensland slowed retail trade and the household spending, costing the economy $2.2 billion in the first 6 months of 2025. That's Treasurer Jim Chalmers saying. He also said that the human impact matters more to us must, but the economic cost is very significant too. The analysis showed that nominal retail trade in Queensland fell by 0.3% in February and 0.4% in March, and household spending dropped by 0.2%. The government will be there for the people in disaster-hit regions, just like they are there for each other, Chalmers said. Elsewhere in Parliament House, crossbenchers were given a briefing on the Office of National Intelligence's Climate Risk Assessment Report, which independent Senator David Pocock described as frankly terrifying. And when it comes to parliamentarian, David Pocock is one of the people you can believe what he says. There are hidden perils too with the new research from scientists at Trinity College, Dublin. They suggest that heat waves dramatically alter different parasites' numbers and their abilities to cause diseases in unpredictable ways. This is ongoing research and we'll keep an eye on it for you. But I do have a positive final item for this week. It comes from the Colorado River in America, which supplies water to about 40 million people across seven United States and also Mexico. Annual consumption from the river regularly exceeds its supply, and decades-long drought, fueled by climate change, continues to leave water levels at the rivers Lake Powell and Lake Mead dangerously low. But now the region's First Nations people are trialling new projects which site solar panels along the river, giving partial shade, while other panels are floating and anchored in the river itself. The panels reduce evaporation and they generate carbon-free electricity. That means that they require fewer dams to produce power because most of the power there is hydroelectric. So far, the project has avoided President Trump's Environmental Act. It's helped by the fact that it's run by First Nations people who are using their own money. Incidentally, a 2022 study found that most of the world's 13 gigawatts of floating solar capacity has been built in Asia. And with the present White House incumbent, that's likely to remain the case. And it completes my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Belinda Baggs. Belinda is the founder of Surfers for Climate. It's an organisation she still has a lot to do with. She's a mum, she's a keen surfer, very concerned about the oceans, the impact that the climate crisis is having on the oceans. So, Belinda, thanks very much for giving up your time and coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me, and good to always chat to you wonderful gentlemen.
Yeah, and so what's up front for you, for Surfers for Climate at the moment? What are you protecting?
Oh, well, there's so much to protect. I think I've personally been trying to focus my energy in positive ways. I spent a lot of years fighting the gas expansion down on the Great Ocean Road, which we had some small victories, and also a lot of energy trying to stop PEP 11, which was off the Newcastle-Sydney coastline over the last couple of years, which has been a major success story, which is absolutely huge. PEP 11's been cancelled, and not only that, we managed to also ban offshore sea mining in all of New South Wales waters with legislation passing through the New South Wales government, which is a really huge win. And, you know, having those positive wins kind of made me realise that, you know, there's only so long you can get kind of buried in the gloom and doom of what's going on with the climate, and, you know, is slapping us in the face. I've recently moved to Yamba on Yagal Country in New South Wales, and since I've been here for the last year, I think we've had about three different floods and one cyclone, which has been, you know, pretty terrifying to sit through, particularly the cyclone. I think there was, you know, 3 or so days of 100 kilometre an hour winds. I was listening to trees, like massive 100-year-old gum trees snapping and falling in the forest, which was really terrifying. And, you know, the community was really on edge because of what they experienced a couple of years ago in the Lismore flood. So there was a lot of anxiety floating around the community. But, you know, on the flip side to that is that, you know, everybody really seemed to empower each other, which was fantastic. Like, we were filling up sandbags prior to the cyclone and everybody's getting in there helping each other. So it's really great to see that, you know, at times of need, everybody coming together and filling themselves with that, you know, that community admiration and really helping each other out. So that's been a positive. Since the cyclone, you know, the water's been brown here out of the Clarence River for months and months on end. We experienced a black water event, which is when all the oxygen in the water is depleted. So there's zero oxygen and it just kills off all the marine life. So there's dead fish washing up, you know, really sad to see so much destruction, also harming some of the fish and other marine life further out into the ocean. And, you know, for us surfers and ocean lovers, we've been, you know, surrounded by brown, dirty water for months on end, some days much worse than others. Some days I wouldn't even go into the water because it's just putrid, and I've heard terrible stories of infections and people getting, you know, cuts so infected that they're losing limbs. And so, yeah, just really trying to pick and choose our days in the water, not to mention the coastal erosion and all the other things that are going on. So there's definitely a lot to be sad about, especially here in New South Wales with the Manning River also just flooding, the worst time ever in history, which is really sad for what everybody's experiencing down there. And my heart goes out to them. So, you know, there's absolutely no arguments along this coastline that climate change is happening here and now. We're experiencing it every couple of weeks. It's really terrifying. But, you know, on the flip side to that, there is so much that we can do. I started an organisation back in 2019 with a friend, Johnny Abegg, called Surfers for Climate. And our mission's really to empower and mobilise a sea roots movement for positive climate action so we can all continue riding waves in thriving oceans for years to come. And we know that that means stopping all the polluting bad projects from going ahead, like the gas drilling you were talking about earlier on, which we definitely lean into. I've spent a lot of years campaigning on the Great Ocean Road and, you know, mentioned PEP11 and some great victories there, which is a huge win. But it also means trying to speed up the progress to renewables as well, and trying to back the things that are going to help us get to, you know, get to lower our emissions in futures to come. And, you know, Surfers for Climate's quite unique in the way that we really talk to a surfing community. We're not just talking to the broader audience. We're talking to anyone who rides a wave, anyone who swims and surfs. And that's, you know, a lot of people from a lot of different walks of life. Sometimes they're politicians, you know, they're part of our club. Sometimes it's bankers, sometimes it's doctors. Sometimes it's people like me who just love surfing and in the past have slept on couches. But, you know, it's a really unique opportunity to talk to people from all different walks of life. And the one thing that we're noticing is a lot of people that are super keen to get on board are women. They tend to lead their communities in climate action. And so just last week we held an awesome weekend called the Water Women's Campout up in Ballina on Bundjalung Country, really aimed at empowering, you know, and growing that ecosystem of passionate and empowered water women to make ripples of change in their communities, which was, yeah, really great, positive way to do things a little bit differently.
Hey, Belinda, we really only get to see these disasters on television, on the news, and or in the papers, and we tend to assume that once they've gone, everything returns to normal. Can you tell us whether the river is still running brown?
It is. Yeah, and so
how long has that been the case?
So the Clarence is usually quite brown. I've never seen it crystal clear, unfortunately. There is a lot of farming that goes on upriver, so a lot of cane farms, a lot of cattle farms, as well as a lot of land clearing that's occurred. So there's quite a lot of pollutants that do run into the river. I'm sure once upon a time it was pristine, but since, you know, us white folk have got our hands on it and tried to use it as a resource, it's definitely not as clean and beautiful as it once was. And so, yeah, it is constantly brown, but the ocean surrounding the river mouth is usually quite blue. Some days it can even get pristine, but yes, since the cyclone Alfred, it's been, yeah, really murky and really brown. So we haven't had what I would call any kind of clean water ever since. Double that with constant rain events. Like I said, we didn't get flooded from the Manning Hunter floods, but we did get rain. So it's kind of continuously pushing down a bit of a brown deluge. I actually did some volunteering the other day with an awesome organization called Ozfish, their local Clarence chapter. And learned a little bit more about the river from them, and got to get into the salt marsh and pull out some invasive weeds, and so it was kind of good to get your hands dirty and actually feel like you were contributing positively. But there is ongoing effects from a lot of these events, from fires to floods, and even what's going on in South Australia with the algae bloom. I think that's still having effects.
You said earlier that the lack of oxygen caused the fish kill. Have the fish returned, or is it still toxic?
I think they're starting to return, but it's killed not just one species of fish. It killed a lot of fish, and I'm definitely not a specialist in this field. All I can tell you is that when you went down to the river, there was dead fish all along the side of the river. Out in the ocean, there was dead fish washing up, and it absolutely stunk. Like, it stunk like death, and it was really, horrifying, to think what was coming out of that river. I've also been told that there's been studies done on a lot of the crabs that live in the river, and they generally have really high levels of pollutants from, farming practices and other things that are happening along the river. So, yeah, there's, in times of flood, everything's way worse, but there's a lot to be cleaned up, not just here, but, in a lot of river systems.
The reason why I am a climate activist is not because I want to protect trees. I'm a climate activist because I care about human planetary well-being, and those are extremely interlinked.
I'm fighting for the trees, for the birds and the bees. I treasure every living soul around my home and beyond. My vision is a world where kindness has won. Friendship means resilience, and green is the color of love. I open my door,
I can feel you now.
I open my door,
I invite the light in.
I open my heart to nature's frequency. I open my ears,
I have learned to listen.
I open my eyes,
I see what's coming.
The key of empathy opens everything I'll ever be. I dream of a world that is clean and just, but I'm aware that requires a major shift. No technology, no matter how smart, it can heal a world that has lost its heart. We've got all the data and all the skills. We're selling magic and solutions and pills. It's a simple choice, it's a matter of will. You don't leave your kids to pay the bill. I open my heart,
I can feel you now.
I open my door,
I light the light in.
I open my mind to nature's frequency.
be kind.
I open my ears, I want to listen. I open my eyes, I hear what's calling. The key of empathy opens everything we'll ever be.
Responsibility, compassion, connection, being human. All of it flows from empathy.
It starts with you, it starts with me. When we stand for what's right and envision what's possible.
This is the power of moral imagination. When we expand our perspective beyond ourselves to future generations and other species, then the transformation will follow.
I open my heart,
I can feel you now.
I open my door,
I invite the light in.
I open my mind to nature's frequency. I open my ears,
I learn to listen.
I open my eyes,
I see what's coming.
The key of empathy opens everything we'll ever be, both within and beyond.
Be kind. I think we should all try and practice more kindness.
Responsibility, compassion, connection, being human. All of it flows from empathy. This is what we as citizens must show that we embody, so that we can inspire others to do the same.
With the key of empathy, both within and beyond the great transition, we can build a world where our hearts align in deep connection and trust. We'll hold the line. So life on Earth will have a future that's safe, not just for a few, but for us all.
It was always going to happen, wasn't it? It was just, oh, this little tiny bubble of hope that maybe they might do it differently. Maybe they might not just pander to the corporate overlords again. Maybe they might, because the people recently elected them, actually do something for the people. But no, it's just more parading and charading and masquerading as usual. And so you're asked to just front up again and care even more deeply. And yet you watch children getting bombed and nothing happens. You watch a planet getting destroyed and nothing happens. They're just eroding the care. They're just trying to beat the empathy out of us. You're virtue signaling. No, you're not. You're giving a shit. But giving a shit is kryptonite to the current system. And so we have to find a way to keep caring. Digging deeper into the reserves of empathy. And yet we just keep getting let down. So disappointing. And, we just got to stop trusting these major parties. We've just got to get minority governments, strong crossbench, independence. It is the only way to break this. We all know it. But we give a slither of hope and we get let down again. Clowns.
Says filmmaker David Gamow on his Instagram page. Belinda, in the Sustainable Hour, in the last month or so, we've been on a bit of a climate-safe community journey, where we have talked to people about this thing about building more resilient and more tightly knitted communities that are ready for whatever is coming, whether that be a economic collapse or whether it be a catastrophe in terms of the extreme weather and so on. It sounds like that you are in that process just as well. So give us some hints and tips. I'm also thinking of poor Alexa, who was at this mental health announcement and clearly very, very desperate and talked about eco-anxiety as something that she had suffered from since she was 15.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that a lot of us are suffering from now, particularly the younger generation. I have a 14-year-old son, and so, you know, my heart goes out to Alexa and everybody in his generation that are really going to be feeling the brunt of climate impacts. I think that's been my driver in actually getting behind and trying to do whatever I can. And, you know, in lieu of having a climate science background or anything that could really help address the climate crisis, I tried to look into my pool of talents and thought, well, what are those? And like, damn, I can hang 10 pretty good. How am I going to positively apply this to the climate crisis? Well, Here we go. Let's try and rally as many surfers as we can for positive climate action. And I think that's, you know, part of what we were trying to do at the Water Women Camp Out was to try and create a strong network of women across the country that can, you know, rally together at times of need, but, you know, also be able to take all this information back to their communities and, you know, empower their board riders clubs, their surf clubs, their families with ways where we can all feel like we're taking positive action. And, you know, sometimes that's getting our hands dirty, and other times it's advocating our politicians to do better and everything in between. So, you know, there is a lot that we can all do, and there's nothing for me personally quite as beneficial to sort of get rid of some of that eco-anxiety is actually doing something. You know, we can complain all day, but if we don't get in and actually do something, then, you know, we're not really positively contributing. So it's just really a matter of finding that way where we all feel comfortable, you know. Like, not everybody might be as comfortable as really brave Alexa, who stepped out there and, you know, spoke her mind to Albo. But, you know, there's other things that we can do. Like at the workshop, Mona Surfers for Climate's things is also trying to protect marine sanctuaries. And we were sort of founded off the back of all the energy from the Fight for the Bite. And we wanted to sort of close that loop by trying to ensure that Great Australian Bight area stays protected forever from drilling, but also other extractive industries. And protected. So we're really trying to push for World Heritage status for the Great Australian Bight. So it's really just protecting those areas. And, yeah, during the camp out, we did a letter writing workshop where we all got sat down and, you know, wrote a letter to our representing MP and told them how important it was for us to be able to protect those spaces. So
how many women did you have in your group?
So there was over 100 women that were there, which was great. The weekend ran for 3 days, but there was also day passes. So some women came and stayed and camped the whole time, which was, yeah, a really amazing experience. And then other women just came in for the day with a day pass.
Can I ask your personal circumstances? I mean, first up, when you have your meetings, do you pass on sustainable living tips on how to get subsidies for putting panels on the roof from the state government and things like that? And do you personally use gas in your home?
I rent. I don't have gas. I guess that was probably just a lucky choice with the house that I'm renting at the moment. I also don't have solar panels on my roof because, as I mentioned, I'm renting. So that's unfortunate. But my father-in-law has a whole roof full of solar panels, which is amazing. The camp out itself really focused on quite a few different things. You know, some of it was about wellness, like so sort of tackling that anxiety that we all have, you know, with the environment and the climate, but also as being female surfers, you know, like it's pretty well known that female surfers have kind of been on the outer for a long time in the lineup. And so really trying to find ways to connect and make a really inclusive lineup, but also diving into solutions like having First Nations representatives there to talk about care for country and things that we can all do to support that. As well as other hands-on things, like we had Ozfish there who were showing us how to make, forget the name of them, but oysters, so like be able to make new oysters because oysters can filter 180 litres of water a day, each oyster, which is really incredible. We didn't have anyone there talking about solar panels, but definitely space for that next time. So, yeah, just sort of equipping everybody with, you know, lots of different things that they can do that might be able to help positively contribute, from letter writing to, you know, restoration, even other things that we can all do in our own homes, like you know, ways to repair our surfboards instead of getting new ones, so cutting our own emissions that way, things like that as surfers.
One thing I can tell you, Belinda, that's happening, which is really interesting in Victoria, is that there's now an experiment where authorities are allowing renters to put up solar panels wherever they can find a space. So, for instance, if you know a business owner who's got a roof, you can put your solar panels up on that roof, and then through, you know, a virtual electricity grid, you can then get your solar power to your rental apartment. It's not rolled out yet, but they're doing experiments with it at the moment. So there's hope for renters just as well in this space.
Absolutely.
In Victoria too, we have a system, that government-led system, which allows landlords to put solar panels on their roofs for tenants, and it subsidizes it. So if you are a tenant, that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have solar panels. You can talk to your landlord or your landlord's representative and say, hey, how about putting solar panels there? Because there's a at least in Victoria, there is support for you, and there are subsidies that cover landlords to update their properties.
Belinda, listeners who would like to, as you say, get more active in their local community, do you have some tips and advice in terms of how to get started, and sort of give some examples of what's happening in your local community?
So I think there's so much that we can all do, and this is something that I'm constantly asked. And I kind of struggle with this answer a little bit, because there's so many things, you know, that we can do at home. Like, I'd like to use my own experiences, and an example is that I sort of started my climate journey rolling tortillas and, you know, making my own almond milk because I didn't want to create the plastic waste, which we all know is from a fossil fuel. But I sort of, you know, after hours and hours every day in the kitchen, was like, well, maybe this isn't the best use of my time, right? And we all do have these limitations around us. And like you mentioned with the solar panels, there's definitely ways around that, but we have limitations. And it's sort of a matter of finding our own superpower and leaning in that way, I think. Like, you know, whilst I still try and cut as much plastic out as I can, you know, make sure that my superannuation and banking is in sustainable institutions that aren't investing in fossil fuels. You know, I buy green energy when I do buy energy, you know, my electricity. Usually try and ride my bike and catch public transport when I can. So there is so much that we can do, but it is limited as an individual. And so I think it's really trying to seek out those community groups in your area. I know there's some in Victoria that are talking about community batteries, which is an awesome thing to get behind. There's other organisations out there that are, you know, and they're not always just organisations. Sometimes they're just community groups, but, you know, really trying to think local and do what we can in that way, like, and pushing our local governments as well. Like, I'm a big believer in, you know, big systemic change over small individual change. Like, there's only so much we can all do individually. You know, my son goes to school, I have to drive my car to work at times. Like, there's things that are out of our control. And so that's why we need to lead in on these big systemic changes that need to happen. And, you know, some of that is infrastructure, some of that is applying your renewable energy sources quicker and quicker, more community batteries, and stopping all this bad shit. You know, that list you went through earlier, the six big polluting projects, like, that's scary stuff, you know, and it's bigger than any individual. And so it's, you know, talking to our elected politicians and making sure that they represent our values, because at the end of the day, I want my children to live on a thriving planet, not a dead one.
There is enough technology, engineering, money, even government policy, international policy. If there was the will to mobilize that, this energy transition could be quite a short journey.
We have to maintain that hope that while it's not going as quickly as we want or as smoothly as we want, that it can still happen and we can leave a better world for future generations.
But it requires people to believe that they're participating in a greater good.
We do have the tools. What we are missing is three things. Implementation. When you scale a new technology, you can say, does it really work? We know now it works. What we have to do now is to industrialize it and scale it like never before.
You need to have trust in the way forward. And also the government needs to have the policy consistently. So if you want to go to that road, you should not change it
after 4 years, after new government.
I think it's very important to understand how the current fossil fuel industries are going to cope with this transition. Because if we don't bring them on board, they become a barrier. And that means reducing the speed of transition, and we can't afford to do that.
We need to transition away from oil and gas as fast as possible, but we need to do that in a safe and sustainable way as well. That can only happen with those oil and gas companies playing a leading role also in the energy transition.
The embedded knowledge in that industry is incredible. Oil and gas engineers could help to engineer offshore wind farms. Sometimes we're fixated on the idea that there's still plenty of fossil fuels available. Why would we stop using them? They didn't run out of stones for the Stone Age to come to an end.
This is the only future that we can really be working towards. It's possible that in 3 decades from now, people looking back at the energy transition will be even surprised that it was such a hot topic, because they would consider it natural that most of our energy comes from electricity, and most of that electricity is produced by wind and solar.
Hard to imagine, but you would have never seen a window here. All of this would have been dry, dead land.
An excerpt from two YouTube videos that a Norwegian consultancy firm called DNV has put out, called The Great Transition 25 to 2050, giving some insights into this idea of looking at the energy transition and the green transition from both sides of the table, both from the fossil fuel industry side and from the youth, the climate activists, who want to see acceleration in the shift to renewables. DNV stands for Det Norske Veritas, and you can find them on dnv.com. That's all we could fit in one surfing-friendly and ocean-focused sustainable hour. Thank you very much, Belinda Bax from Surfers for Climate. Belinda, we always end our hour with a Be the Difference kind of statement. What would you want to be, or what would you think, recommend our listeners that they should be?
Be kind. I think we should all try and practice more kindness. I think you're right in what you were saying earlier, is that sometimes it's reaching out to these fossil fuel executives in a kind manner. Sometimes it's reaching out to our politicians in a kind manner, and hope that they're listening, and also being kind to one another, because spreading the hate isn't helping anybody. So we need to really lean in and, you know, be a community, be a solid, caring community for each other, and be kind to those that are in power, and yeah, let them know, let's use our voices in a kind manner that will hopefully get us a better future.
I love that, Belinda, and that so much rings all the bells in my world. Be kind.
Yep, you go along with that one.
This is not a time for wallowing in despair and hiding under the covers. The stakes are just too high.
They've ruled our world for 2 centuries. Black gold was the lifeblood of our economy. They paid their way to block any regulation. But the tide is turning, and now power is free. Demand the shift, and then you shift the demand. The world is changing 'cause you take a step.
don't need CDs, those factories close. Coal and gas is in an even worse collapse. No need to ban it, we won't have to fight it. When the market starts moving, it will be killed overnight. Demand a shift, and then you shift the demand. The world is changing 'cause you take demand a stand. We set the course, we draw.
It's an old cliche that we should be the change we want to see in the world. Well, the most effective way to do that is to increase demand for the components of a sustainable economy. Every pound, euro or dollar you spend makes a difference, and you should use it to demand a different world.
We plug into sun, we harness the breeze, we drive electric, we're planting trees. We choose the brands that play it fair, demand a future without despair. Demand the shift, and then you shift the demand. The world is changing 'cause you take a stand. Change the system lies with us when we move together. We shift the gear and we are changing the story. The world is safer now because we start the demand.
Fossil fuels are a dead end for our planet, for humanity. Yes, for economies.
Demand a different world.
Let's play together. Love it.
We literally don't know the Earth. We don't know where we live. And but furthermore, we don't know who we live with. Our understanding of invertebrates and vertebrates and creatures and birds, etc., is just now sort of opening up to the idea that plants, insects have consciousness, have language, have emotion, have these qualities that we have never associated with the living world. And that is we're on the cusp of a huge breakthroughs in science and understanding, you know, not just that whales speak, they do, and we understand that, and we have obviously primate behavior studied by Jane Goodall and others in terms of their communication, but we're talking now about bees having emotion, and this is science, this is not projection, and that's what I mean about, that's our family, that's our kin, not biologically, you know, in the sense of genetics, but without whom there is no life on Earth. And so to give a sort of expansive sense of the words you read, the complexity and the majesty of this place, it just changes perhaps your sense of respect. And then maybe it changes your sense of what you are doing or not doing as a denizen of this planet. You know, you're here, you come, you live, and you go. So what are you going to do while you're here? Are you going to increase life on Earth? Are you going to decrease it? Are you going to destroy what has taken a billion years to create? And we've lost 70% of our mammalian population in the last 50 years. That's a pretty rapid decrease. Or are you going to act in such a way, live your life in such a way that absolutely creates more life, not only for your children and your children's children, but for all people who follow us. And actually, the fact is that by and large, indigenous people, that is to say, the tribal cultures, and maybe tribal is not the quite right adjective, have been doing that for tens of thousands of years. And you could say, well, they didn't have a choice. Fair enough.
They didn't have technology. They didn't have ways not to, but they stayed in a place and they learned to live there. And it taught them how to be, in a sense, not just the caretakers, you know, but the progenitors of life in that place, that is to create more life. And so if you look backwards and you look at the record that we have that we're putting together anthropologically and biologically of people who lived before the settlers, before the colonists, before they were, in a sense, discovered and then, you know, rapidly in many cases, not terminated, but, you know, exploited. You find people who have extraordinary way of seeing the planet. They could hear plants. We thought, oh, yeah, right. You know, we are mocking them. They actually can hear plants. They can communicate in such a way. They see a world differently. Well, they've been there for thousands of years, had lots of time to learn how to do that. We've been here, I say, the settler colonists have been here a relatively short time. Now, I don't mean to exempt China, India, and cultures that go back 4,000 or 5,000 years. Those are different than the settler colonist cultures that I'm referring to, who came in from Europe to the Americas. But I think what I'm trying to get at is, like, there's so much wisdom around us. There's so much knowledge, you know. The future is not in intelligence. The future is in knowledge. And we're all calling up on AI. It doesn't matter whether it's artificial intelligence or not. The future is in knowledge. And knowledge is gained in a completely different way than intelligence.
I woke up feeling like the world's on fire. Storms arising, rivers running drier. But then I tuned in, turned the dial, and found a reason to stay inspired. They said the greatest threat is thinking someone else will do it. But I can feel the change. I know we're moving through it.
Time is running out.
I heard it on the sustainable hour. Hope alive and the time is now. We know how.
Carry on just being the difference.
They talk of profits, pipelines, and delay. Though we got voices that won't fade away.
To see and understand the bigger
picture. From city streets to the coastal sand. We're backing leaders to take a stand. They said a society grows great when we plant trees in whose shade. We know how.
Be the difference.
You can do it.
A new industrial revolution, powered by millions of sustainable innovations, is essential.
Unite in a national effort to save from destruction all that makes life itself worth living.
Nobody will believe it's possible until we show them. But when that day comes, you know what they'll say? They'll say that it was inevitable.